Hello, everyone. This is your Captain Wade speaking, and I'm joined as always by my co-host and executive officer, Will.
Welcome aboard.
Let me tell you guys and gals, this is going to be a really fun episode for me. As you know, last episode we were talking mostly about ships of state. These were large ocean liners that came to symbolize or were directly funded by the nations under which the flag they sailed. Of course, last episode, you heard me gush about the lovely Lady Normandy. However, I'm sure more than a few of our listeners are thinking, what about the USA? Didn't we have one of these ships? Yes, we did. But I'll be getting to that in a little bit. As for now, I'm going to provide a bit of background on the man who built this absolutely fascinating ship that Will is going to cover. Honestly, this man is amazing, and I think you know this man's name, Will.
I do. Some of our
This,
listeners might know, though he's not as well remembered today as he should be.
yes, this man is honestly, he's a 20th century. I think he's up there with, say, the Rockefellers or the Carnegies. This guy's amazing. This man is named William Francis Gibbs, which is funny because I actually have a professor who's named exactly the same. Well, I should
Wait,
say
really?
it's his last name is the same. Born in August of 1886 and died in September of 1967 at the age of 81, Gibbs is considered one of the best naval architects of the modern era. However, that begs the question of what is a naval architect? Okay, well, since you're the engineering student, what is a naval architect?
Well, naval architecture is a kind of specific form of engineering that's dedicated to designing ships. It's a very specialized field. There's only a few schools in the country that teach it. Probably the best known naval architecture program at the moment, outside of, actually the Navy, is University of Michigan, interestingly. But it's a very, very specialized field focusing on hydrodynamics and structural strength and all kinds of interesting factors that you have to think about when you're designing ships that most people don't have to think about when they're working on big engineering projects.
Yeah, as you can imagine, ships are incredibly complex when you come to the size of an ocean liner. But that all the more highlights the brilliance of Gibbs and his brother, Frederick Herbert Gibbs. We have to give him credit as well, who often worked with him on his projects. Gibbs seemed to have a fascination in engineering from very early on. In 1905, he began pursuing engineering at Harvard College. I never thought of Harvard as having an engineering program, but I guess they do, or at least they did.
No, they still do.
Yeah, and he used plans of British battleships as his case studies. However, it would appear that Harvard was not the place for him because he left without a degree. I wonder if he flunked out because of his own pursuits, or if it was more that he just didn't fit in the school. That may be lost to history.
I've got a
However,
copy of his biography at home. I'll have to check because I don't know exactly why he left, but I do know he was essentially self-taught as a naval architect.
However, it would appear that, like I said, Harvard was not the place for him. And then it's also reasonable to assume that his father, who was a financier, basically big time banker, for lack of a better term, didn't approve of his son becoming an engineer, which is a bit flabbergasting to me because in the modern day, being an engineer is considered a very worthwhile profession in any capacity. So he ended up attending law school at Columbia and graduated in 1913. Then, at his father's insistence, he practiced law for 2 years. And I can only imagine that Gibbs was chomping at the bit for those 2 years the whole time. But anyway, that couldn't keep Gibbs or his brother down for long. In 1915, they came to the attention of J.P. Morgan and his International Mercantile Marine Company. When eventually we get to talking about White Star Line and their later history, J.P. Morgan and the International Mercantile Marine, or the IMM, will come up again because they have a big part in that story. Which was, like I said, a fancy term for Morgan's attempt to monopolize shipping on the high seas.
Pretty
Yeah.
much.
You were going to say, Will?
I was just going to say, yeah, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah, it didn't work out so well. The brothers had put forth designs for two 1,000-foot ocean liners in 1915, mind you. By 1916, they had the backing of the Admiralty of the US Navy and the Secretary of the Navy, and then financial backing from JP Morgan's company. Sadly, the events of World War I would put the kibosh on these designs. Gibbs did become the company's chief of construction in 1919, so you could say his career was off and running at that point. In 1922, though, Gibbs and his brother chose to go independent and started their own naval architecture company. It went by a different name at first, but would in 1929 acquire the now famous name Gibbs and Cox. And the first test of their design skills as a company would come when the United States lines came into possession of the SS Vaterland, one of the big three German liners that Will talked about in our previous episodes. However, the shipbuilders at Blohm and Voss in Germany refused to cough up the plans for the renamed SS Leviathan. So, along with over 100 drafters and undersigners, they built up plans for the ship themselves and rebuilt the interiors of the ship and brought her up to American code. This made the Gibbs brothers rock stars in the world of naval architecture. You can imagine that designing a ship from the ground up is difficult enough, but designing a new, you could say, machine spaces and interiors for a ship that's already there, that probably would have been a nightmare.
Well, and to make matters even worse, as Wade mentioned, the Vaterland was seized by the US as a war reparation. So the Germans were not thrilled that we had it. Not only did they refuse to provide the builders' plans, before they handed it over, they actually rerouted all of the steam lines to the toilets so that the toilets were spouting steam constantly. So they basically sabotaged it. And so not only did Gibbs have to sort that out, but they also completely rewired the ship's entire electrical system. And this was a 900 plus foot long ship. So you can imagine how much wiring that was. I think it was several miles of wire. So this was a huge project.
I can imagine that Gibbs and his brother at times were just shaking their heads and going, "Why did we get stuck with this?" But in the lead up to World War II, the Gibbs and Cox Company would be kept extremely busy with designs for liners all over the world, and these are brand new liners, mind you, and for multiple companies. They weren't pigeonholed into one particular company that they would only work with. Some of the more famous names were the Matson Line in the Pacific, the Grace Line, and the United States Lines for the much beloved SS America, which kind of served as a forerunner to the ship that Will is going to be talking about very, very soon. However, all nine of the ships that Gibbs designed in this period would be built to a standard of safety, sturdiness, and speed. This would come to define Gibbs's design philosophy, that and very, very distinctive funnel shapes.
Yes.
But then World War II rolled around and Gibbs and Cox were in the thick of it. During that time, not only were they responsible for the design of the Fletcher class destroyers, which are a much beloved class of destroyers, and they were very prolific. They were also responsible for the design of the famous Liberty ship transports, which were a bit of a departure from Gibbs's usual idea of building very strong, very sturdy, and I guess you could say quality, maybe not quality built, but definitely not up to the standards that he normally would have insisted upon. But when you understand the volume of ships that were under the Liberty ship class designation, you understand that, yeah, you might have had to cut a few corners to make sure that they were at least out there. Do you recall, Will, how many Liberty ships there actually were?
Several hundred. I can look up the exact number. The Victory ship, which was the design that was based on the Liberty ship, was actually even more prolific. I think we built something like 2,000 of those. Just absolutely incredible. In fact, and one thing that was important about Victory ships and Liberty ships is that they were largely built out of prefabricated components that were farmed out to a lot of companies in like the middle of the country that weren't traditionally shipbuilders. And so this enabled the US to build tons and tons of these. And the speed record for building one, there was a Victory ship that start to finish from laying of the keel to launching the ship, 4 days.
4 days.
4 days.
And as
go ahead.
As I recall, it was also one of the first ships that used welding as opposed to riveting for a lot of its construction.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm fortunate because where I'm from, we have a Victory ship as a museum in our town. And it's an interesting place to visit. And they haven't done this lately, but they used to give day cruises on it, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, but
yeah, so the Liberty ship was just an incredible achievement. My other favorite Gibbs warship design, which is really unusual, is, believe it or not, in the 1930s, the Soviets, of all people, hired Gibbs to design a series of warships for them, which they never ended up building, but they were really interesting. One of which was a over 900, possibly 1,000 foot long hybrid battleship that had a complete flight deck plus 12 16-inch guns.
Holy crap.
Yeah, so you can imagine what that must have been like. And so that's one of his more unusual designs, which were really wild. I also wanted to mention too, Wade mentioned that he built a number of ships for the Matson line. His four famous liners for the Matson line were the Mololo, the Mariposa, the Monterey, and the Lurline. And these ships were just really incredible. And I have a family connection with them because my great grandfather was a harbor master for the Port of San Francisco and was responsible for the loading arrangements on the Lurline, which is one of the ships that Gibbs designed. And these ships lasted a really long time in service. They didn't stay with Matson their entire lives, but the Monterey, I think, due to the Mariposa or the Monterey, became the Britannis for Chandra's lines. And I don't think she was retired until the early 2000s.
Wow.
Okay. I got the number. The number of completed Liberty ships is 2,710.
Holy crap. Yeah.
And there's now, two.
Yeah, two left. And for all of you that are from outside the U.S., this is the true demonstration of why the U.S. was considered such a powerhouse during the Second World War. We could turn out thousands of ships. Thousands.
Yep.
That is nuts.
And they were being built anyway, all over the country, too.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you've got 3,000 miles of land, that makes it a little easier. But yeah. Regardless, I should say, by 1946, so just post-war, almost three-quarters of all American naval vessels had origins of some kind with the Gibbs & Cox Company, whether this was full designs or working plans or just partial design schematics, you know, say for a specific part of the ship. That's prolific in the best sense of the word. This made the Gibbs brothers not only pretty darn rich, but extremely influential in the government, as you could imagine, when their designs command three quarters of the U.S. Navy.
Yeah, post-war. Another aside, sorry to interrupt. You mentioned the Fletcher-class destroyers. I just checked the numbers on those. We built 175 of those.
Yeah, yeah. And to put that into perspective, the Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, I think they just passed 30, if I remember correctly.
I think we got more like 60 or 70 of those. But the Fletcher class is the most prolific single destroyer class in history.
I can believe it. But like I said, post-war, this influence would come in handy for Gibbs's magnum opus. And I think it is time to turn it over to Will. I'm sure you're bursting at the seams for this one.
Absolutely. Okay, so just to answer your previous question, we have currently completed 67 Arleigh Burke-class destroyers. So
okay.
They're catching up, but not quite at the Fletcher level.
Nope.
So anyway, going back to Gibbs and his accomplishments, Wade mentioned the SS America, And that was kind of the forerunner to the SS United States, or what would become the SS United States. And so Wade mentioned that Gibbs had been designing these sort of fantasy liners for years, since 1915. And he had his long held dream was to design a premier transatlantic superliner to fly the American flag. And mentioned we had not really been a major power in the transatlantic trade up until this point. And there's a variety of reasons for this, but the bottom line was that the British especially, and then the French and the Germans really dominated the transatlantic passenger trade. And we were kind of an also-ran for most of the great liner era. The notable exception being the Leviathan, which was the ship that we were talking about earlier, the captured ex-German liner, the Vaterland. That was the first ship which could really be considered an American superliner. But unfortunately, she wasn't terribly successful. One of the reasons for this was because during Prohibition, U.S. flagships were not allowed to serve alcohol on board in accordance with Prohibition. But foreign ships did not have the same restrictions, so a lot of people chose to sail on foreign ships to get around that. So that's one of the reasons why the Leviathan was not financially successful and was eventually laid up in the mid-1930s and replaced with two smaller liners, the Manhattan and the Washington, which actually were fairly successful. But anyway, Manhattan, the Washington enter service in the early 1930s. Their kind of most famous thing was Jesse Owens sailed on the Manhattan to get to the 1936 Olympics. But anyway, around this time, the United States Lines decides we want to build a bigger ship to sail alongside the Manhattan and the Washington to become America's flagship. And so they hire William Francis Gibbs to design this ship, and they received some backing from the U.S. government on this because it was seen as a New Deal era project to bring more jobs. And so this ship became the much beloved SS America, which we could do an entire episode on just by herself. She's considered one of the most, you know, beautiful and beloved ocean liners in history by many people. She's definitely a fan favorite. She was completed in 1940. So you can see why there may have been some issues associated with that. She did have parts or artwork or other contributions to her construction from all 48 of the states that existed at the time. So it was definitely considered a national project. And the America entered service in 1940, as I mentioned, but because World War II was already going by that point, she did not enter transatlantic service. She instead became a cruise ship ferrying passengers from New York to the West Coast via the Panama Canal during this period. When World War II began, the America became the USS West Point, a troop ship, and served with distinction alongside our allies for the duration of the conflict and then returned home. Now, I mentioned that the America was the biggest passenger ship built in the United States up until this point, but she still wasn't that big compared to other ocean liners that were being built in other countries. The America was about the same size as the Mauritania II of the Cunard line or the New Amsterdam of the Holland America line, but she was not up to the same size standard as the Queen Mary or the Normandy, and she was significantly slower. I think her top speed was 24 knots, whereas the Queen Mary was 31. Now, we talked in last week's episode about ships of state, that the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth together were able to shorten the war by a year thanks to their enormous troop carrying capacity, capable of carrying 16,000 troops. And so while this was going on, the U.S. Navy was watching this and they said, hey, we need one of those. And so after the war, the U.S. Navy and the United States Lines, the premier U.S. flagged shipping company, cooked up a scheme to finally build a true superliner for the United States. And America, the SS America was kind of the practice run for this in many respects. But of course, who else would you hire to design this ship than William Francis Gibbs? And he was absolutely elated to be working on this project. And so the project for what was then referred to simply as the big ship began in 1948. And Gibbs began designing it. And he had already been kind of working on it on his own because he wanted to do this for such a long time. So he really just adapted some of his previous designs. Now, the big ship was designed for several purposes. It was intended to primarily be the premier transatlantic passenger ship, but it also had this naval mission in mind of being a troop ship. And so one of the conditions was she had to be convertible into a troop ship virtually overnight. I think it was 48 hours was the standard for how long it would take to convert her into a troop ship. And in her troop ship capacity, she had to be able to carry at least 14,000 troops, which constituted a full division at the time. So this really kind of put the size, in hand of how big the ship had to be. The other thing was because she was being built with this military mission in mind, she had to be built to Navy safety standards. And so unlike many passenger ships, she had a really rigorous set of safety systems in place, to the point where her watertight compartments built to naval standards were so tough that she could have taken the same collision as the Titanic with an iceberg and made it home safely. Now, there's precedent for this because the first major liner that Gibbs built on his own, the SS Malolo for Matson Lines, had a collision on her maiden voyage with a freighter that was almost as severe as the Titanic's, and she made it home under her own power. So he knew how to do this. The other thing was she had redundant engine rooms. And so if the SS United States had been struck by a torpedo, like the Lusitania had been hit by in World War I, she could have continued on at 22 knots, even after taking a torpedo hit, which is pretty impressive. So the other factor is that Gibbs was completely obsessed, probably to the point of going a little too far, with fire safety. And this was born out of his experience watching the Normandy burn. We talked about this in our last episode, that the Normandy tragically caught on fire. And so he was determined that this would never happen to his precious baby, so to speak. And so the big ship ended up having only two wooden objects on the entire ship, the butcher's block and the Steinway grand piano. He even tried to get around this. Apparently, the butcher absolutely refused to use anything other than a wooden butcher's block. And Steinway refused to make an aluminum piano, although he apparently tried. So complete fire safety. A lot of, modern materials were used in the design of the interiors, including lots and lots of asbestos, which became a problem for this later on. But he was also very innovative in how he put his team together. He was one of the first major engineering project managers to include female engineers and designers on his team. Oh. So the SS States propellers were designed by Elaine Kaplan, who was a Jewish, I think she may have been an immigrant, woman who was the first female ship propeller designer, which is a very specific field, but that was a major contribution. And then he also hired two women, Dorothy Markwald and Ann Urquhart, to design the interiors of the SS United States. And he did this because he recognized that the women in the households of the time were usually the ones who actually made the decisions as to which ship to sail on. And so he wanted the design of the ship's interiors to appeal to them. This team of women had also designed the interiors of the SS America previously. So he kind of kept a lot of his team together. The interiors of the big ship were a departure stylistically from previous ocean liners. And in today's perspective, maybe not a good one. The America had beautiful late Art Deco interiors with a lot of streamlined modern design features, and her successor, the big ship, had a more kind of 50s mid-century modern look to it, which was a lot more stark and not as decorated, not as rich feeling on the inside. It was considered contemporary and fresh at the time, but it hasn't necessarily aged very well, and a lot of people who sailed on the ship later remarked that they felt like they were sailing in a hospital. This was also partially because it had to be so easily convertible to a troop ship that it didn't have a whole lot of like luxury fittings. The other thing too is that one of the reasons why the fire spread so quickly on the Normandy was because she had these vast interior spaces, like that giant dining room that Wade was talking about that was longer than the Hall of Mirrors. And that dining room, I think, was a three-story high space. And so Gibbs wanted to avoid having huge volumes like that on the inside of the ship because it would be harder for a fire to spread if you had smaller rooms. And so the big ship didn't have, big sweeping interior spaces like that either. So anyway, construction on the big ship began in 1950, and because of the military nature of the design, a lot of aspects of the design, including her underwater hull form, were kept secret. The other major factor of the ship's design was trying to make her the fastest possible ship. This was for two reasons. It was necessary for her military service, and it was also a prestige thing. The United States finally wanted to take back the Blue Riband of the Atlantic, or the transatlantic speed record, which we had not held since the mid-1800s. So it had been about 100 years since we had held the transatlantic speed record. In order to do this, Gibbs took a very lightweight ship. That one of the reasons why the ship ended up being so fast was because she had an all-aluminum superstructure, and put battleship engines in. So she had the same power plant as a Midway class aircraft carrier or an Iowa class battleship. So serious horsepower. I think her installed horsepower ended up being, I think, over 250,000. And so she had four cross compound triple expansion Westinghouse turbine sets with double reduction gearing to the propeller shafts. And yeah, so I just checked the numbers here. Her total horsepower was 240,000. So that was by far the most horsepower that had ever been put into an ocean liner. So anyway, all this was kept very secret, though. The details of her power plant, the hull form, all of it was classified as a military secret by the United States Navy. So
Don't forget,
anyway,
everyone.
I'm sorry.
Don't forget that during this time, when the SS United States, or at this point just the big ship, is being laid down and starting construction, the Iron Curtain is dropping in Europe, and the
Right.
Korean War is just starting as the first real proxy conflict of the Cold War. This
Right.
is a time where the United States really buttons up security to make sure that the Soviets could not get any information that could be used against us. Because let's
Yeah.
not forget that the Soviets had, I believe, just gotten info on how to build a nuclear bomb from our own scientists. So the US was very concerned about security at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, we were very concerned about the Soviets. So, anyway, there was a lot of speculation as to what this ship was going to be called. But eventually, when she was launched in 1951, what else would we call the flagship of the US Merchant Marine but the SS United States, which was the perfect companion to her running mate, the SS America. So we go for patriotic names, at least in this line. And so that she was thus christened. There was a lot of anticipation as to what would happen when she finally entered service. One of the other aspects of this was Gibbs deliberately made her sound heavier than she actually was by using an archaic measurement system. So she was rated at 53,000 tons, but because he used this weird old measuring system to get that number, that was kind of obfuscating, and she actually weighs about 45,000 tons. So that's another reason why she, had additional speed capabilities. She went on her sea trials. Her sea trials results were classified. And so there, to this day, there's still a lot of speculation as to what exactly happened on her sea trials. And I have heard several different numbers as to the top speed that she actually hit on her sea trials. The most generally accepted number is over 38 knots, which, think about this, the Queen Mary's record-setting speed record in 1938 was 31 knots, okay? So this is almost a quarter or third again as fast as the Queen Mary. She is also known to be able to back up at about the same speed as the Titanic could go forward. So that's also pretty impressive. I think her backup speed was about 22 knots. And but to this day, there are people who swear up and down on their life that she actually went a lot faster on her builder's trials. And the story that I heard is pretty wild, and I don't know if this is true, but it came from the one of the chapters of the SS United States Conservancy. The story is that she actually had two sets of builder's trials, and that on her ultra secret first builder's trials, This person claims that she hit 50, 50. Yeah. And I don't know if this is true or not. Okay. But he claims that she topped out at 50. And then the US Navy realized that if she really could go that fast, she could outrun any ship in the Navy, which could possibly escort her. And so then the Navy had her deliberately handicapped by reducing the output of her boilers. And then she went back out for a second run where she got the 38 knot top speed. I don't know if this is true, but it's an interesting, you know, story. I've also heard on the sort of third number that I've heard on her top speed, that's sort of in the middle in terms of credibility. The 50 thing is kind of out there. The 38 is absolutely for sure she could go that fast. The third number that I've heard, which is sort of a maybe, is 43. I've also heard that she's capable of hitting 43 knots in good conditions. Either way, any of these numbers are absolutely incredible. You know, just completely outrageous for a ship of that size to go that fast. So anyway, she completes her builder's trials and then she enters service in 1952. Her maiden voyage departs New York City on July 3rd. And so on the 4th of July, she's out and about on her maiden voyage. And of course, the speculation is rampant that she's going to try to make a run for the Blue Riband on her maiden voyage. The Queen Mary didn't on her maiden voyage. She waited a few times because one of the things that was interesting is that Cunard, the company that owned the Queen Mary, was trying to keep their image as a safe and dignified company. And so they thought it was bad for their image to be going after speed records when they should be focused on safety. And so when the Queen Mary took the record, they just said, oh, we didn't really intend to do that. That just happened. And so when the Queen Mary had been built, they had made this thing called the Hales Trophy, which was supposed to be given to the fastest ocean liner. But the Cunard line turned it down because they didn't want to have that image associated with that. So anyway, the SS United States goes out on her maiden voyage and then returns to New York. On her maiden voyage, she averaged over 35 knots, which meant that she beat the Queen Mary's record by 3.9 knots, which is probably the widest margin ever of breaking, you know, the transatlantic speed record. When she arrived in Southampton in England after her record-setting voyage, a British newspaper said, after hearing all of the hyperbole surrounding the SS United States, it comes as something of a disappointment to find it all true. and then I think the Queen Mary sent her a congratulatory but also slightly snarky message. I forget what it said. But anyway, the SS United States firmly took the transatlantic speed record, but it's telling to me that she shattered this record, getting up to 35 knots. She never went over two-thirds of her power on the entire voyage. So, yeah. So she could go faster. Now, one thing that's worth noting is that there is not a linear relationship between horsepower and how fast you can go when it comes to ships. Once you get above 30 knots, it gets harder and harder to get extra knots, to the point where I think above a certain threshold, trying to go three extra knots requires double the power. But I'm just saying, Big U, as she became known, affectionately known, could go a lot faster than her record-breaking top speed of 35 knots. The other reason why this was important is because she actually had a service speed of 31 knots, so she didn't usually go that fast. But because she had this enormous reserve speed in her capabilities, she was never, ever in her entire career late. Because if there was a storm or something, she could easily make up the lost time with all of her extra power. So she entered service, was immediately successful. The one challenge that the United States Lines had was that it had two very mismatched ships in their service. So the Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth of the Cunard Lines were roughly equivalent to each other. And so it was very easy for them to maintain a schedule. Because the United States was so much faster than the America, it was harder for them to calendar out their voyages. But they made it work, and the SS United States became kind of the ship of the 50s. She was the most one of the most popular liners of the era. Anybody who was anybody sailed on it. Joan Crawford was a frequent guest. The Windsors, who are rather controversial British ex-politicians, frequently sailed on her. A lot of movie stars did, all kinds of people. I'm sorry?
Walt Disney did.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, he did. She also featured in several movies. There's a movie called Bon Voyage starring Fred McMurray, which was set on board the SS United States. I've seen it. It's very cool. She also appears in the sequel to Gentlemen Prefer Blondes entitled Gentlemen Marry Brunettes that was set on the SS United States. So she was kind of a pop culture icon. Her other big movie appearance is in the movie West Side Story. The opening scene kind of panning over New York flies right over the ship as in the harbor. So that's kind of cool. So anyway, this ship was in service until things started to change in the 60s. So as we've mentioned several times, 1958 was the turning point for the transatlantic trade. That's when the jet airliner, the Boeing 707, entered service. And you know, after that, intercontinental jet travel kind of became the way to go. And the United States' passenger numbers started to diminish. She did require a government subsidy to run, like a lot of other big passenger ships. And so in the 1960s, this subsidy was becoming increasingly burdensome for the U.S. government. In 1964, the America was retired by the United States Lines, and she was sold to Chandris Lines, a Greek company, which renamed her the Australis, and she became actually very successful in her second career as an immigrant ship from Europe to Australia, because at the time, Australia was offering generous incentives for people to immigrate to Australia. So that's what the America went on to do. But the United States soldiered on for a few more years. After the America retired, the United States pooled her schedule with the SS France of the French line. And so kind of like the Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth alternated weekly sailings, the France and the United States maintained the schedule together. So that was kind of a neat example of international collaboration. But eventually, even the mighty United States was too much for the government to continue to subsidize. And so in 1969, the United States was retired. Now, unlike the America, the United States could not be sold to another company because she was still a classified military secret. And so she remained tied up for a very long time, basically just sitting there. In the 80s, interest began to grow in turning her into a cruise ship. And one of the reasons why this was an interesting idea is because the U.S. has something called the Jones Act, which means that if you're a passenger ship, you have to stop at a international port before stopping between U.S. ports if you're not a U.S. flagged ship. And one of the reasons for this is they were trying to protect the U.S. maritime industry. So in order to sail directly from a U.S. port to another U.S. port, you have to be an American flagged ship. And usually, in order to be an American flagged ship, you have to be built in America. And so by the 80s, the SS United States was one of a handful of ships that met this requirement. There were a few proposals. There was a gentleman who purchased her. I don't remember his name. And decided in the early 90s to convert her into a cruise ship. Well, the problem is that since the 1950s, it had been discovered that asbestos was not something that you wanted your passenger ship loaded with. And so he made the momentous decision to completely gut the SS United States' interiors and take out all the asbestos, which admittedly was necessary if she was going to be put back into service. But the place to do this was in, I think it was Turkey. So they towed her across the Atlantic. She went back across the Atlantic again to Turkey, where this work was done. It was the subject of a major Greenpeace protest at the time because people thought that the process by which the asbestos was being extracted was not environmentally friendly. And then
actually,
she was
brought, a little bit of an addendum to that.
Sure.
Now, the original plan was to take the SS United States to Turkey to have the asbestos removed. But when they tried that, basically the shipyard that was going to do this, they kind of looked at this and said, "We can't do this," and basically pointed them to another shipyard in Ukraine that would
Okay,
be able to
thought there
do
was
it.
a Ukraine connection. Okay, thank you. Yeah, so it moved around the Black Sea a few, a little bit to get this done. The problem was, once she made it back to the US, the company that was doing this was no longer financially stable, and so they ended up abandoning the project. So they had gotten as far as ripping out all the interiors, but they had not put anything back in. And she ended up changing hands a few more times. In 2003, she was purchased by NCL, the Norwegian Cruise Line, which at the time also owned the Independence, and I think it was just the Independence, one of the former American export lines, ocean liners. And the idea was to turn her back into a American flagged liner, possibly to help with their Hawaiian cruise operation because Hawaii was a U.S. port. However, they never followed through with this. And the Big U just sat there and sat there and sat there, getting an increasing disrepair. Eventually, NCL did get their American flag passenger ship with the fantastically ugly Pride of America, a cruise ship that was partially built in the US, or at least enough of it was built in the US to meet the requirements. And so they did not end up putting the United States back into service. Well, anyway, this kind of came to a head in 2011, when NCL decided that they were going to sell the ship. Now, at this point, most of the bids were going to come from scrapyards. But there was a dedicated and committed group of people called the SS United States Conservancy, which was run by William Francis Gibbs' granddaughter, who still runs it to this day, who were determined to save the ship. And so they put up a big fundraising campaign, and it didn't look like they had enough to buy the ship. But at the last minute, a gentleman named Len Fest from Philadelphia swooped in and donated enough money for the Conservancy to purchase the ship for $3.5 million from NCL. Mind you, this was $3.5 million 2011 dollars. When the ship was originally built, it cost $78.5 million 1952 dollars. So the depreciation curve kind of hit the Big U pretty hard, but it worked out for the Conservancy. And to NCL's credit, they sold it to the Conservancy, even though they got a higher bid from the scrapyard. So, you know, they at least kind of had the foresight to try to do something to save the ship. So the Conservancy bought it. The Conservancy has owned the ship since 2011. She's currently tied up at a dock in Philadelphia behind the Philadelphia IKEA. So if you ever find yourself in Philadelphia and you want some Swedish meatballs and you also want to see America's greatest ship ever built, you can go to the Philadelphia IKEA. But anyway, she's been there ever since. And the Conservancy is diligently working to try to get a better situation for her and a more permanent home. There are some people who are defeatists on this issue. We are not fans of those people on this podcast.
No.
There are reasons why this is a viable proposition. The current idea that the Conservancy has is they are trying to get the ship moved back to New York City to become a permanent museum dedicated to the transatlantic shipping trade in her former home port, and also serve as a space for other things, whether it be there's ideas of having a hotel, ideas of having a business incubation space. I mean, think about it this way. The interior volume of the SS United States is roughly equivalent to a Manhattan skyscraper. So that's a lot of real estate that you can work with. And because her interiors are completely gutted and don't have any more asbestos in them, it's a completely blank slate for whatever you want to do. Now, unfortunately, she looks kind of rough on the outside because she has not been repainted since 1969. But although she looks kind of bad on the outside, they did a structural study on her a couple of years ago and found that her hull still has 90% of its original integrity. So the ship is in really good structural shape. In fact, actually much better condition structurally than the Queen Mary is. And so there are a lot of reasons why I think this is a viable idea. In fact, as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, they were in talks with the company Crystal Cruises to try to actually reactivate her as a functioning cruise ship They ultimately decided that that would be too expensive, but it's a lot less expensive to convert her into a static display. So they're currently working with a company called RXR Realty to try to make this a reality. You know, right, they can't really publish a whole lot of details about the negotiations at the moment because it's all confidential, but we are all very hopeful that the sad story of neglect of the United States is going to come to an end, and she's going to have a glorious, triumphant second act as the fixture on the Manhattan skyline that she deserves to be. I'll mention her most iconic exterior feature are her two gigantic funnels. I believe they are the largest funnels ever put on a ship. Enormous, red, white, and blue, instantly recognizable. And some people find her funnels overly large and vulgar because of how big they are.
Nah.
Personally, I think that they're perfectly sized because, like anything in the United States, the SS United States is a big, bold, bombastic, take no prisoners design. And if you look at her just in profile, I think that the United States is the most beautifully proportioned ocean liner ever built. I think it's just the way that all the design details worked out, the proportions were just perfect. I think her earlier predecessor, the America, some of the detail work on the America was I think a little bit better. But overall, just the overall design, that the big U is simply magnificent. And so I think she deserves to have a future, both as a testament to her creator, William Francis Gibbs, and all of his contributions to the world, and as a reminder of the U.S.'s seafaring heritage. And the fact that, you know, after many, many years of being an also-ran in the transatlantic trade, we finally got our act together and put out just an absolutely stunning, spectacular ship that, you know, firmly put us on the map. And, you know, the other reason why it's important to keep her is now there are only a handful of classic ocean liners left. The other ones are the Rotterdam in the Netherlands, which is another reason why the United States has a future, is because the Rotterdam was similarly restored and put on display. The Queen Mary, the QE2, Queen Elizabeth II, and then there are two that are actually still in service. The Astoria is a cruise ship, formerly the Stockholm, of 1948, is still an active cruise ship today, which is pretty cool. And then the ex-Soviet liner, Alexander Pushkin, is still in service. So that's basically six classic liners that are still around. There's also a smaller ship, the Funchal, which was a Portuguese liner that's just also being put on display right now. So there's several precedent examples for why the United States has a future as a display. And so I would encourage all of you who are listening to get involved with the SS United States Conservancy. If you go to their website, there's several ways you can help. One of which is to donate to their efforts, because they have a heavy carrying cost of keeping the ship docked at this dock in Philadelphia. But also there's other ways. If you're not comfortable donating monetarily, there's other ways to help. You can help spread the awareness of the issue. You can, if you happen to have a lead on artifacts from the ship, the Conservancy is working on trying to collect as much furniture and artwork from the ship as possible so that they can start to reconstruct the interior spaces. Lots of easy ways to help. There's a recent book by the author David McCauley about the SS United States called Crossing on Time. And he was known for a series of other books that he made and illustrated talking about how various big engineering projects were done. So he did a book about pyramids, another one about castles. I think he did one about the Empire State Building. And now he's done one about the Big U. So lots of easy ways to help. And I think if we all band together, it is absolutely within our capabilities of saving this vitally important piece of maritime history. I always tell people, if the Netherlands, which compared to us is a comparatively small country, was able to save the Rotterdam, we are able to save the United States. And we really hope that you come away from this episode with the same amount of determination that we have to see this project through.
I agree wholeheartedly, Will. I back up every single word that you said in that. So thank you for that public service announcement to the ocean liner enthusiast community. And I will say this, it would be a crying shame if the SSUS does not end up in New York and possibly in the most bombastic city in the US. It makes sense that the most bombastic ship that ever sailed the Atlantic is there. So
yeah.
In any case, I can hear the water coming back into the dry dock. We are out of time for today. It's been a really fun episode, don't you think, Will?
Oh, absolutely. We got some interesting ones planned in the future too, so stay tuned.
Yes. But for those that have been listening for a while or have had thoughts about our show and have wanted to say some things, we now have the opportunity to receive email from our listeners. If you have episode ideas or critiques, believe you me, we're trying to learn as much as we can. The email now is inthedrydockpodcast@gmail.com. Again, inthedrydockpodcast@gmail.com. And if you reach out to us, either me or Will will respond and let you know that we are taking your comments and your feedback to make sure that this is the best podcast about maritime history that we can. Believe you me, we want to make this as best, the best it can be.
And we're also open to guest presenters. So if you have an interesting topic that you'd like to share, let us know.
Absolutely. And on that note, Will, I will say fair winds and calm seas.
Bon voyage.